Happy Monday and welcome back to the Voices of Biotech podcast. I'm Millie Nelson, editor of Bioprocess Insider, and as you will be well aware by now, this series we're talking all things green and looking at different aspects of sustainability in the biotech space. This week, we're bringing you a really exciting conversation with Jeffrey Whitford from Millipore Sigma, where we delve into the importance of people, education, and the benefits of embracing discomfort to bolster sustainability efforts. We really hope you enjoy listening, and please stay tuned for next month's episode.
My name is Jeffrey Whitford. I'm the Vice President of Sustainability and Social Business Innovation for Millipore Sigma. And with my role, I get to oversee and help lead the transformation and really how we embed sustainability into our business processes, thinking about making it really systematic. So instead of having a really nice story here or there, how are we fundamentally changing how our business operates to really take sustainability into account in business processes that change how the business actually runs? And I think that's such a great opportunity to be able to partner with the business, right? It's not sustainability doing all of this. It's really this really remarkable connection between big ideas and then the 28,000 people who make our business come to life each day. And that's really where the power and the energy from sustainability comes from, is those 28,000 people who bring this all to life.
Such an important point, because I think you can have all of these sustainability initiatives or goals that you're working towards, but without the people behind it and the actual business strategy to execute it, I can imagine it would be pretty hard to even get the goals, but to get the data and the metrics that back those up, that they've happened. And you've mentioned there what you're working towards, but could you give us some specifics if you have some specific goals at the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things is really being clear about what we're trying to accomplish. And for our business, we've set out three big objectives that we want to drive by 2040. And then we have interim targets. So it doesn't just feel like, oh, wait, that's forever away and it'll be fine. Someone else can take care of it. So from a 2040 perspective, one, we want to drive human progress for 1 billion people in 2030. And when you look at that, that can happen through a variety of ways. So our organization has three business sectors, a healthcare business, electronics business, and the life science business, which I represent. So with that, you've got a combination of treatments, therapies that we provide through our healthcare business, but then also within our life science and electronics businesses. How do we transform these materials that are used to help manufacture or make other materials, maybe in the pharma industry, or could be academic research that can really bring about new transformational technologies? And so we contribute to that target by thinking about all of the different ways that our products contribute to kind of an extended benefit, if you will. That's goal one. Goal two, super important because it addresses kind of the network of the world that we live in, right? And this is really about supply chain transparency and ensuring and really working so that we're driving transparency into the supply chain and really sustainability being at the core of that, so that the suppliers that we work with, which it's a significant number, you're talking about tens of thousands of suppliers, are really where the impact lies. So for us, it is approximately 92% of the footprint sits within scope three. And then if you go a level deeper there, 75% of the footprint sits within our purchased goods and services. So those are the materials that we take and transform to make the products that we sell. That's really where you see, this is not a situation, I think, Millie, it's really important that we are not saying you suppliers have to figure this out. It's really about partnership and how are we going to work collectively together, because there's a wide range of maturity when it comes to sustainability acumen and action. And so how are we a helpful partner using the experiences that we've had to work with the suppliers versus saying, you have to do this, right? I don't think a stick approach works in this instance. So we're really focused about the partnership aspect and using the lessons we've learned to help really shine a light on business benefit, right? Opportunities for operational improvements that you can find that turn sustainability from this perceived cost to really a benefit for organizations around the world. The third goal is really the one that I think we're all going to connect with. It's kind of the easy no-brainer, and that is climate neutrality by 2040. So here, scopes 1, 2, and 3 from an emissions standpoint. We also want to think about how we're using other resources. So really being as efficient as possible with resources like water, for instance, minimizing the amount of waste that is generated, increasing circularity within the business, and making sure that our waste streams, think about wastewater, right? There's zero or no effect concentrates in those wastewater streams. From us, climate neutrality is big, right? There's not necessarily full clarity on how we're going to get there, but I think we are being much clearer about the roadmap with our science-based targets initiative goal that was confirmed in May of 2022, that we have a glide path that takes us on a credible path to get to that target of climate neutrality by 2040. And for us, and I mentioned interim goals, so as we were talking about 2030, we have a 50% reduction in scopes 1 and 2, and then approximately a 30% reduction in scope 3 from an emission standpoint. So those help us anchor something that it feels near, it feels more urgent, and we're really held to accountability with that and it not being so far out.
I'm just going to take you back to scope 2. Because supply chain is something that we hear so much about and how pivotal that is in the role of sustainability. And I completely agree with you, that stick approach probably isn't going to work. But I'm also going to ask you, I'm assuming you give your suppliers some goals that they need to work towards, and they need to be willing to do that for you to be willing to take that partnership on with them. And that is how it moves forward, and you both then reach the same goals together.
Yeah, and I think it's one thing of understanding where people are at. That's the starting point. So that you are not really bombarding them with things that are maybe too advanced or too complex. And that understanding of where they are kind of on a maturity matrix helps you fine tune or refine the suggestions, because you can start with, I would say, more simple things like renewable electricity. One of the things that we want to see, we have a renewable electricity target. We want to be at 80% renewable electricity across all of our businesses by 2030. Right now, we operate at approximately 76% renewable electricity. So we're like almost there. We know that in the beginning of 2026, our new VPPA in Europe will go live, and that will catapult us to 90% renewable electricity. So we will be past that target. So one of the things that confirms for us is, A, it's possible. So one of the things that we want to do is make sure we're not asking people to do things we're not doing ourselves. So we can say, we get it. We understand the challenges. We've been there too. But we think we can help you work through this, and here are some options you can choose. And then we get into the more complex things like energy efficiency investments at your facilities. How do you bring down your scope 1 and 2 emissions, right? And really work to first, you know, if you can tackle the renewable electricity, then how do you drive down your energy demand? And really thinking about how do you move from scope 1, which is traditionally, let's say, natural gas, related emissions, how do you move that to electricity so that then you can offset that with the renewables, right? So you see this progression happen. But it is really walking teams through this so that it doesn't become overwhelming or burdensome. And then you go into like the vast unknown, which is the more challenging stuff. Changing raw material sources, looking at your manufacturing processes, and could you change the scientific approach, catalysis step, right? All of these other things. And that's where it's a different level, right? So I think what we want to be clear about is understanding where people are at so that we meet them at that point, and then we give them tools, advice, access to our experts who can walk with them through that. Because I really just believe at the end of the day, that's going to be the way that we get to success versus we expect you to do this. If you don't do this, there is, you know, this kind of like punishment's probably not the right word, but like there is this thing that will happen. So yeah. I really take the mindset that we are going to do this through partnership, and that is how we approach it. And it's a unique view. I don't see that happening a lot. I'm on the receiving end, right? This is the great piece, is I get to be on both sides of the coin because I am the company that needs to have these things happen, but I'm also the supplier. And so I get to experience what this is like from a lot of large pharmaceutical companies, a lot of academic institutions. And so the range of experiences helps really inform how we do it differently and hopefully how we can model success and then hopefully scale that success to more people outside of just our organization.
You've raised such an important point, and it's one that I haven't heard too much, but it's that idea of education. You have to educate the people why you're doing it. It's okay to say, this is what we're aiming for. But if people don't understand necessarily why or how to get there and have experts on hand to be able to say, this is what we're doing and this is how it works in our business, it must be really, really difficult for anybody who's entering in a partnership or doing something with a company to get to that point. So I think that's really, really important that you've mentioned that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think about, so in a previous life, still at the same company, I had a 1-year rotation in procurement. And when that happened, I can tell you procurement was not on my career manifestation board, but it was one of the best things that could have happened to me because I really learned how the business operated. It was a really just kind of like drop into this reality that I had not known. I knew it more from a like marketing perspective. And so that change of perspective helped me then understand something that I think really influences my perspective now. I bought snake venom of all things to buy, very random, but I bought this from a man in Louisiana who I could just go out on a limb and guess is probably not clear on what his carbon footprint is, right? And to be honest, he probably doesn't have a huge carbon footprint. But the point of the matter is that situation is probably more often the reality than the other side of the coin where people like, yes, I have a complete emissions inventory. I'm using the GHG protocol to do this. I report to CDP. I have a science-based targets initiative. I have done the EcoVadis assessment. Like there's so many places you could go. And not acknowledging the potential need for education really creates a blind spot that I think we can't afford to overlook. And so for me, that component of really anchoring myself back to that experience is helpful as a reminder to just say, let's double down on that. Like, I don't think we ever lose out by focusing on education. I think you always win, right? So the upside of over-education is definitely there versus the downside of being like, oh, they'll figure it out. They could Google it. Well, let's not assume that. So I think it's a really great point.
Definitely. And from your perspective, I'm sure sustainability has been creeping up for, been here for forever. But from looking at it in, a journalistic eye, it seems to be this hot topic that of late has just boomed. And every company understandably wants to say that these are the initiatives we're working towards. These are the strategies that we've got to get to our goal. But I can imagine for the people who have maybe been doing things the same for a very long period of time, it wouldn't be beneficial to just, this is what you're now doing, change everything. And if not, there's going to be some consequences and you might lose out on some business because that will just kind of shutter companies down rather than making them grow and make the changes knowing why.
Absolutely. I think you can look back and I have been in this space for more than 15 years now, not what I thought I would be doing, but so appreciative that I get to do it because really my kind of like life goal is how do I have an impact that's bigger than what I could do individually? And I get to work with an organization that can have a big impact, that can be a bright shining light for change and for the successful implementation and integration of sustainability into business. But if you think back to 2007, I think that's when I saw one of the first articles in the Harvard Business Review about sustainability kind of as this concept and like the, you know, kind of a bright, shiny object, but very trendy within, you know, business. And it definitely gave the flavor of like, okay, this is going to be like a little bit of an arc and then it's going to go away. And I definitely had people who said that to me, like in our own organization, when I started doing this, they were like, that's a fad. We're not going to, don't have to worry about that. And what was really interesting was I saw a different lens to this. I started my MBA right as I kind of moved into a different version of this role, you know, kind of back in the day, you know, smaller, more contained and really kind of like opportunistic and doing spot things here and there. But that combination of integrating my the business education, if you will, but using the lens of sustainability of how I did it really transformed my view on what sustainability could do for businesses. I joke with people, and I think I said it this week, I was meeting with some colleagues in Germany, and I said, if you think I am sitting there hugging trees, running around or skipping around a field of daisies singing kumbaya, you have missed it. No, this really is about the business value that we can create for the organization that reduces the use of unnecessary materials. It makes things more efficient. It decreases risks. When you look at that, I'm like, what an awesome mandate that you get to do. But now the transition, and certainly at that point, the kind of awareness of the effect of carbon wasn't as strong. But now there's a metric that can help guide it. And we've got to be careful not to let carbon become the tunnel vision of the only thing, right? You've got so many other things, from biodiversity to water to waste to more of the S topics, if you will, thinking about DE&I, thinking about equitable labor, modern slavery, so many topics, it just balloons out. But I think it's a reminder that for us as a business, the benefits outweigh the perceived, I think, like compliance or these other risks that people bring up. There are real opportunities to strengthen how the business runs, to help reduce the future-proofing, you know, challenges that we face. I'm not going to say it's going to answer all of them, but I believe it strengthens us as a business. It makes us more magnetic as an employer. Our employees are like, there's a great comment that I saw online about like the company. They were like, they really care about sustainability, and in parentheses, almost too much. Great. Like, if that's the feedback I'm getting, great. Because that is probably the toughest test, is the people who are inside the walls who see it happen and can tell, is this a load of stuff or is this actually meaningful and are they doing what they're saying? And I think we always have to remember we've got to prove that. We've got to make it relevant to the business, to our employees, to our customers, to our stakeholders. But I think that's where we as an organization have really connected those dots and are understanding how all of these things fit together to make it a consistent, relevant topic that isn't a trend or a fad.
Definitely. I mean, greenwashing, obviously, I would never name names, but you could pick, and I don't mean just in the biotech space, but across any industry, sustainability is something that everybody's working towards or saying they're working towards. And I think taking it past that, oh, we're doing this, this and this, that's what's important. And that's what will really drive positive change. You did mention about looking at different raw materials, different ways. How has Millipore Sigma found that with the regulatory standpoint? Because I've spoken to a few people and they've come up with, let's say, plant-based processes or a different material that's easier for them to source and it's more sustainable, less carbon footprint. But the one thing they say is it's now convincing regulatory bodies, but also convincing their customers that this works the same, if not better. Because I think as humans, we like familiarity, and it's nice to be like, we know that works, we know that's safe for us to have. And when something new comes in, the first thing, some people embrace it and some people will just think, fear. No, not until it's like a fully validated concept will I try it.
Yeah. So I'm gonna reverse my order of answer, because I think the question and the last point you brought up is so relevant. And I'm gonna use that as my anchor point, and then we're gonna circle back to the regulatory aspect.
Amazing.
Because it is an extremely important component, and for us a really meaningful partnership internally with my colleagues in quality and regulatory. But the change component is one that we mustn't underestimate. So one of the things in the years of meetings that I've got to have with customers, the experience that is most common with that is really this: we want to do something related to sustainability. We present you with an idea of what could be done. And then you're like, uh-huh, okay, thanks. And it comes back to, and this was an eye-opening moment for me. You have people who aren't prepared to handle change. And it's understandable, because exactly what you said, we're humans. We like the knowing of what is going to work and the kind of consistency of that happening. And we're trying to solve really tough problems, right? So if you think about the person who's working to try to figure out, how do I solve cancer? I'm really interested in, maybe it's this very specific thing about a type of cancer and how that protein or that inhibitor works. They are not interested in changing some very basic process that's at the very early change of this and having to spend mind share on that. And I think that was a moment that opened my eyes to say, wait a minute, we got to do something differently. So I went on an exploratory journey to understand what the education landscape looked like. And what I came to find was that there is very limited, very, very limited curriculum on things like green chemistry. It is just not being taught or integrated. I am not an advocate for green chemistry as a standalone thing. At the end of the day, green chemistry is chemistry, right? Hopefully we get to the point where it's not green chemistry, it is just chemistry and it's integrated, and we're thinking about how do we reduce hazard? How do we reduce risk? How do we think about the environmental impacts, the CO2 footprint of these things, and using different materials? So one of the things that we did to address that was a significant partnership, really thinking about the scientific ecosystem from an academic view. So we partnered with an organization called Beyond Benign that really works to help drive green chemistry curriculum into and partner with organizations, academic organizations, so that they've got resources to help their professors, to help their adjuncts, to help the teaching assistants know and get high quality information that they can then take and create their curriculum, right? Because one of the things I've also learned through this is academic freedom. They do not want to be given like, here, take this, use this. They have ownership. And okay, great. But I want you to own it and use it. Like, that's the thing I need. And I think that's the piece that we're really starting to see momentum and movement on. You asked about kind of metrics, goals. And I think this is another one where really a lot of, or most everything we do, we think about this in terms of what are we trying to accomplish and can we put numbers to that accomplishment? So with Beyond Benign, we want to ensure that there are approximately 14.5 million students that have been exposed to and are able to implement green chemistry starting in 2022 was the first kind of start of it, really fully going in 2023 to 2030. So that's kind of the frame that we're looking at. But you think about the number of institutions. So we're trying to target hundreds of institutions. Right now, I think the number is 161 in terms of the number who have signed the commitment to integrate green chemistry into their curriculum. But that becomes one of, I think, the biggest kind of sea changes that we hope to be a catalyst of, is to change the education environment so that people are prepared to use this lens, right? It's not about just it's green chemistry for green chemistry's sake. It's using the lens to say, I'm asking a different question. Could I do that reaction using different materials to get the same result? And is now there a greater body of literature out there that helps me do it and have more confidence to do it more effectively or quicker or faster? Now, that then takes us to the next hurdle, which you mentioned, which was regulatory. And I think on the regulatory topic, it is so crucial. And you see a very differentiated landscape from a regulatory environment in different geographies. And certainly a recognition about the opportunities that exist. And I think one of the things that we are very fortunate to have within our organization is a remarkable quality and regulatory team who have such ownership of making sure that we A, understand the regulations, and B, that we're working to transition our business to meet them and to be able to digest the variety and the differences of the regulatory environments around the world. Just yesterday, I was meeting with colleagues to talk about how do we bring our frameworks together so that we are collaboratively addressing things like how do we introduce new products to ensure that we are not introducing challenges into systems, right? So that we're thinking about the ways that we can eliminate substances that could be risks down the road. And I think that type of partnership is really important and critical so that we understand each other's worlds and that we understand that we're mutually working together for a similar outcome or goal. But what we know that we've got to have is it's about more data. And you talked about convincing regulators. And I think for me, that is not my space of ownership. But I think what's really important is having the data to showcase the due diligence of really being mindful of these different hazard classifications. And how are we thinking and guiding R&D work to try to solve and tackle problems that they are no joke. They are tough. The answers don't just exist, right? They're not there and we're just not doing it. We're trying to figure out how to make it work, but it is a challenge. And the volume of data that you need to, I think, really give regulators, I don't know if comfort is the right word, but you give them a better sense of the diligence that's gone into the evaluation and analysis as you work to make sure you're not introducing regrettable substitutions, right? Because that becomes an even bigger risk. But I think that component is an important one that I'm fortunate and thankful for the partnership that we have with our quality and regulatory team to help guide us through that, because that is definitely not my space of expertise. And I'm so thankful that that team is there to help really navigate with us.
Thank you for answering all of that. I know I did that kind of in a two-part question, which I seem to do a lot, but no, I appreciate it. That was a great answer. just going back a little bit about the green chemistry academia, is there a specific geographic location that you're targeting, or are you trying to roll this out globally across academic institutions who want to take part?
So great question, and it's the world, right? We are not, you know, I think one of the things, it's very easy when you come from one part of the world to be focused and know that. I think working for the organization that I work for, we are extremely global. And it means that we need to have global solutions and we need to be inclusive globally. So we definitely started in home markets, we'll say that. We definitely started in the US, but we are now expanding into Europe with the goal to expand then even further to Asia, Africa, South America, so that it really is truly global. Because at the end of the day, these problems exist everywhere. And so if we can level that up, and so the consistency is around the world, our impact is just going to be greater. So, and I forgot, Australia. Don't want to forget Australia, but our folks in Australia as well. We've got the whole world in our sights, really thinking about how we impact that ecosystem.
I think as well, that brings up an important point about the talent pool, because you speak to people who have these new ways of creating a more sustainable product, a greener product. Sometimes I have spoken to people in the past who say, we're lucky that we've managed to find people who we can train and they're willing to learn. But also, I can imagine from a student perspective, if you've been at university, you've done all of this education, you've worked really, really hard, then you step into your first job and all of a sudden it's a lot of things you haven't learned about. That must be quite daunting if that hasn't been in the curriculum.
Yeah, and I think it becomes an interesting, and I think one of the more convincing arguments doesn't feel like the right word, but that we have with academic institutions, if you think about one of their measures is how successful are students once they graduate. And we look at this and say, look, the hiring environment is changing. And this is something that pretty much every single company has a goal related to. So if you have students who are able to go into these environments and apply these skills, they are going to be ahead of most others, because we know it's very limited in terms of the application. And I think that's, it's a light bulb moment, because one of the most frequent things I also hear is like, well, you know, what are you looking for in student? And now we very clearly can say, because if you think about our organization, so I have a team of approximately 35 people, 28,000, which I mentioned earlier, in our organization. So obviously 35 people cannot do all of this. You think about our R&D organization, there's approximately 1,900 people within that world. So what I need is to upskill those people, and they have leaned into lots of trainings and lots of dialogue on this. But what happens if you can inject somebody in who's had this already and they hit the ground running, and you bring this kind of fresh perspective? Because I think the other thing we also see here is the students are in university right now, right? This is like, they've grown up with this. It's an expectation. It's not a like, oh, that's a novel concept. And so when they experience it, man, they grab a hold of it and they are ready to roll. And I think that, Millie, is where you see a game changer in terms of career readiness. And this being such a really, I'm not going to say it's without its cost. It's not a huge cost that you have to like, but changing curriculum takes time, and time is, you know, they have to invest in that. But if you think about it, you are not having to go out and like change an entire building, right? And retrofit something. You are changing how the methodology in which, or the curriculum you teach. And I think that's the thing, is like the return on investment here, I think, is so high for academic institutions. And more importantly, for the students who are investing a lot of money in certain geographies in the world to get that education. And so it really is a great opportunity to get them ready to go out into the marketplace and to really succeed.
Sets the future talent up for reality as well. Like you said, I don't want to say it's generational. I feel like that might be a bit harsh and a bit of a, you know, sweeping statement. But like you said, if that's something that you've grown up with, these are values that will be with you as a person. Moving to a company, that's more attractive to move to a company who say, like, we value this so much. And to make things successful, you have to have the same values, don't you, to succeed in any career. If the organization you're working for doesn't have the same values as you, and you're not willing to work on those values, I think that's where you see people not liking their job, or not putting all the effort in. So you get the best out of the person, and then we can presume the best product.
Absolutely. I think when you walk into an environment and then you understand part of your goals include things like sustainability and the outcomes from like product design, right? So we think about how do we change our product portfolio through our SHAPE design for sustainability framework. If you're a new joiner and let's say you are younger, you're coming out of university, you're like, man, this is already baked in. I don't have to advocate for this. Because I think a lot of people come in and thinking like, you know, I get it. Corporations, like the big bad corporation, they're just messing everything up. Well, I don't know if that's a, you know, talk about sweeping assumptions. We all have room for improvement. But I think when you walk into that environment and you see that there are very clear paths forward in terms of expectations of the number of products that are delivered, and we've mapped that out and we want to increase the percentage of those on an annual basis, rather significantly, your perspective changes, right? I think your contribution probably changes because you're like, man, these people get it and they're doing it. And I didn't have to be like, you know, spend time advocating for them to do something different. It is just already there. So I think you're absolutely right, is when you don't have that dissonance with your environment, it creates a totally different place for you to contribute and hopefully be your best self and to really deliver all that you can bring.
Great to have those goals. I know they're future goals, and of course they are, because they take a while to get to them. But if you're looking at 2030 and 2040, they're goals that they're coming up. So if you're already in the business, you're looking at it like, okay, we'll start here, but we need to get here by this point. And I'm part of that journey to helping it get to that point. So I think that's really positive. We spoke about green chemistry leading to greener product. I'm always interested on the life cycle of a product. What's in place? Because it's great to have a great beginning, a great middle, but what happens at the end? Is there a strategy in place to try and minimize that environmental impact at the end of the life cycle?
Yeah, so it really depends on the type of product you're using. So, and this is where we as a company that have more than 300,000 products, it gets really hairy at times. Try to understanding each and every situation that you could possibly come across. I think we're a bit of a realist when it comes to that, but we think about these bigger groupings. So you've got consumables, and most of the time those get used up in a process, or there's maybe a little bit left. So hopefully you're able to use them in some experiment or some process. So consumables, a little bit of a different story. But then you get to things like devices and instrumentation, and especially thinking about biopharma manufacturing, a lot of single-use technologies, which have really become the kind of go-to approach that companies are taking. And so here, what's really interesting is before, I think there was limited awareness of the amount of energy and the amount of water that was used, especially in the cleaning and sanitation process of the stainless steel systems. But what it didn't leave was anything physical. Right? It went down a drain, or it was on a grid and you didn't see it. And so, like, you know, no muss, no fuss. Not the case, right? So then we get into the world of single use, and now there's actually physical things left. When you look at the life cycle of these two approaches, there is data available that shows that the single use methodology does have a lower footprint when there is recycling technology available. Now, there's going to be some people who are like, recycling is a joke or horrible. They're not completely wrong, right? There's more advances that can be made there. So I'm not going to be the person who is like, it's wrong, it doesn't do, it's not the answer. I'm the person who's going to look at it glass half full and say, okay, proof of concept, we need to advance and change how we're doing it. And that's where we come in, right? So in 2015, we introduced the first biopharma recycling program to take a look at these materials. And that approach is really a mechanical recycling approach, meaning that it comes in, it gets decontaminated, it gets shredded, and then it gets extruded into something that is downcycled. So you're not going to come out with the same quality because it's a mixed plastic. So there you're getting things like park benches, parking stops, pallets. So I will be the first to say we probably have maybe close to the amount of park benches we need in the world. So we probably don't need a ton more of those. So then the next challenge is to say, okay, mechanical recycling technology was then. Where do we go now? And I think this is where you have two promising technologies, one kind of nearer term and one longer term. So you've got chemical or advanced recycling, and that comes with its own set of yikes moments. But I think what we're really working on there is how do we change it to not get it back to a fuel, but instead to get it back to the monomer or the polymer so we can get it back into the product? Because ultimately, that circularity is what we're aiming to do. And important to what you asked the question before about kind of the ambition scale for the academic engagement is the same here. So that mechanical recycling program is only available in the United States in the Northeast. Well, guess what? There are other places in the world that use single-use technologies, and they do not currently have something to do with those things. In a complex environment, transparency is, I think, numero uno. What is happening with those materials? How do we have visibility onto it? And how can we ensure that they are in a contained environment and they're being treated carefully because of the exposures that they have in the processing standpoint? But once we are able to deal with that step and have that transparency, how do we go about the transformation? So we do think that there's some aspects with chemical advanced recycling with, I will say, a big asterisk. I don't want people to hear me say this and be like, well, that's another hot mess. There are things that need to be solved there. Energy use is one example. We're working on all of those things and then the technology to be able to extract those materials back to get them back in the product. Then longer term, we look at something that's very interesting, but the technology is just not as developed, but it really shows promise. And that's biological or enzymatic recycling. We look at that and you take away some of the challenges that you have with the chemical or advanced recycling, but then you have another set of challenges that get created. So it's not like it's just like, ooh, this will be fun. There is a lot of work to be done, but I think this, Millie, is where we are really focused on A, solving big technical problems, and B, being global about the solutions that we come up with. And then C, dealing with regulatory challenges, like the fact in Europe, right, you can't move that material across country borders. And what you actually need here is you need efficiency of scale. So you need volume, and it's difficult to get volume in a block of 27 countries where it's segregated, and you can't pull it all together because at that point, having 27 of these processing facilities does not make sense, right? So I think we're trying to figure out some not insignificant challenges, but also not insurmountable. I think that's another thing about our team and how they look at things is like, we can do this. We will figure it out. We don't know when, we don't necessarily know how, but we believe because of the past successes that we've seen that we are equipped and we're curious and we've got the support of our organization to go about and figure them out because it's one, I think the right direction to go. And it's going to be stronger for everyone involved, right? If we can have, if we can produce medicines with a much lower impact without having to introduce new virgin plastics, that's solving a really interesting challenge, but it is not for the faint of heart.
I think that brings up to me that idea of creating a full ecosystem. It's great if you have things in a certain geographic locations, but like you said, there's the whole world. And at one point, I'm sure there will be a time where there's a complete ecosystem where it all feeds in together and everybody can then kind of go from the same page of the book. But it's important to have those small steps and small changes because that will facilitate a bigger change later on.
And I think your comment on the ecosystem and realizing that is really important because at the end of the day, it is a big economic model. That's the thing that we came to realize. And for us, you know, we're not the chain part where the economic piece matters tremendously. It is really on the processors of the material. It's on the waste collectors who you have to think about the financial component of. And if we, you know, I think a lot of the time it's easy to be like, this technological solution works. But to your point, in the ecosystem, there are so many other parts to make that whole thing work. And you have to be aware and understand what are the motivations or the drivers for that to work. And if it doesn't work and one of the pieces of the chain breaks, then guess what? You do not have a solution and you really have a challenge. So I think this concept of the ecosystem is something we have really been mindful of helping to craft and curate. You know, and I think another important piece about that you made me think of too is that this isn't a solution just for our products, right? It's for any products within the single-use environment for biopharma manufacturing because, like, let's be honest, it makes zero sense to try to be like, oh, we're only taking back Millipore Sigma products. No, nobody cares, right? That is not the customer's problem or challenge. Like, they just want to be able to have whoever they choose to use that. On a broader scale, we want to be catalysts to bring that solution, but we also want to be available and partners for the broader industry as a whole.
One thing I found so interesting about this conversation, I think you've really delved into the fact that sustainability is about the people. And it goes even so far as you can work for the same organization and you might have the same goals, but everybody works slightly differently, even in departments, you know. And you find that in life in general anyway. You could be in the office and one thing that somebody's like, oh my gosh, that's so long and that process to do this, but to the other person it has to be done that way, else there's problems later down the line. And so it makes complete sense in the terms of sustainability. You have to understand why people are doing things a certain way and how education and coming up with a plan, I guess, of how you can all move forward, but it doesn't make life really hard for one set of people. It works for everybody across the board.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I learned early, and I coach my colleagues and basically whoever I talk with, is about meeting people where they are at. It's not where you are, right? And some, it's just so easy for us to go into situations and we've got our perspective and that's what we're operating on. But it is a totally different ballgame when you can walk into a situation and a person feels heard, where you create space to listen. It's a 180, right? And I think that's been one of the keys to our success, is that we have really created space for people to shine, who this isn't their job. They've either voluntarily decided to get involved, you know, it became a KPI that they contributed to, but they really started to own it because I think we heard them. And don't get me wrong, there's still better listening and more listening we can do to continue to improve. But at the end of the day, I think that's one of the things that I hear most frequently from people is, one, they feel really good about what we're doing. They see it. It's real. We are very focused on the numbers and sharing the numbers and being transparent. Like, my team operates with a mindset of radical transparency. And it can be uncomfortable and not fun, but like, that's where we go because it holds us accountable. But that accountability and consistency show people that this is here to stay. It shows them places they can plug in, because that's the hard part too, is you look at sustainability and there's all ranges of solutions that need to happen, whether it's something as simple as recycling paper in the office, or, you know, an initiative to like send less emails, to really complex stuff of re-engineering processes or changing materials out, or, you know, changing an entire packaging system. Your level of engagement, you've got to have options for everyone. And I think that's where we try to do a better job of listening and figure out where we can connect people in, because the power of the community is an unstoppable force, right? When you get that moving and people feel they can plug in, and the, I won't say other side, but another part of what I get to do is our community engagement work. And, you know, scientists aren't necessarily your number one kind of personality facing persona, if you will. But what happens when our scientists get to go into classrooms, get to be a volunteer at our curiosity queue, you see them light up, being able to share what they do and concepts that are definitely scaled down for the audience. But you get to see them in a whole different light, where they are so brilliant, so smart, very serious at times. And you get to see this other side of them comes out that still taps into who they are at their core and what they love to do and what they love to share. But you see that powerful thing happen. And I think that's just another, you know, component, right, Millie, of listening and seeing the opportunity and creating spaces for people to be uniquely themselves. And share and shine with their quirky personalities in a space that's welcomed, right? And there are these little people who light up when they get to experience these things. And I think as adults, anytime a child is like interested, because I think we all know what an 11-year-old could be like at certain moments, but when they are like enthralled and just you see the light bulb come on, that is one of the best forms of gratification of like, you did something good that day. And I think our employees really personify that around the world with our programs Spark and the Curiosity Cube and Curiosity Labs.
Kids will tell you the truth as well. Totally. So that's the other thing.
No bones about being very clear about what they think. The filter is just not there yet, which is fantastic.
I love that sense of community in terms of sustainability, because you have to feel a part of it to really push and make those changes. And, you know, you made such a good point. It could just be sending less emails, recycling your paper, deciding that maybe you don't need to print that much that day. You're all making that contribution, even if it might seem small in that scale of the business, you're still doing something towards sustainability and also towards meeting the company's goals.
for me, really thinking about just asking a question. When you're doing things, how does sustainability, maybe it's not your driving force. You know, I get it. Not everyone's going to go there. But how do we just ask a question and start really facilitating a change environment where we think about a change that we could make that could improve things? Because I think it starts with asking the question, and the question is the catalyst to bigger things. But if we're not willing to ask the question, if we are just comfortable in the everyday and kind of what we experience, and sometimes that season of life is what you need. And so I'm not going to be the person who's like, nope, all the time. It has to be uncomfortable. But I think if we're willing to just open ourselves up to a little bit of maybe discomfort from change, there are some pretty remarkable things that can be accomplished. And I think the world, unfortunately, is in high need for more of us to be a little less comfortable and figure out how do we make a change.